support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's a stretch to say something encouraging about Haiti these days. Various groups opposing President Aristide have taken over some of the island's cities. Aristide's supporters are crouched behind barricades in Port-au-Prince, vowing to fight to the death. Aristide himself has called for assistance from the United Nations, and officials in the U.S. and France have appealed to the president to resign. In this spectacularly uncertain time, the country's national soccer team has been doing its bit to encourage Haitians. With successive wins over the team from Turks and Caicos Islands late last week and again last weekend, Haiti earned the right to play Jamaica in an attempt to qualify for the next World Cup finals, which will be held in Germany in 2006. Joining me now from his office in Miami is Santos Perez, who's been following the Haitian soccer team for the Miami Herald. Mr. Perez, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The two games in which Haiti beat the team from Turks and Caicos Islands were both held in Miami. How was the decision to play the games there reached?
Basically, the officials from the Haitian Soccer Federation felt the situation in their country was not safe enough to host a World Cup qualifier. I'm sure that FIFA also had its eyes set on that as well. And it was a safe option because of the large and very passionate Haitian soccer-loving population here in South Florida.
Did Haiti have a kind of home field advantage in these games, both of the games?
Without a doubt. There's a large following of Haitian soccer fans here in Miami, and this is not a rarity seeing the Haitian national team play here. They have played here in other tournaments, such as in the Gold Cup tournament 2002, where they drew more than 20,000 fans for a couple of the matches here. So it is not a rare occasion having the Haitian national team play here. As a matter of fact, they will be playing again in Miami March 13th against the U.S. national team in an international friendly match.
One of the Haitian players, Peter Germain, learned shortly before Saturday's match that his house back in Haiti had been burned down, yet I gather he was determined to play. He didn't hesitate.
He said it when he first reacted, obviously was distraught and really emotionally affected, but he realized that being part of this team could be the remedy for some of the ills that's plaguing the country right now. So the fact that he was part of a team that could develop into something special allowed him to temporarily at least put aside the problems that are plaguing him back home and concentrate on this match.
What sorts of other personal stories involving the players did you discover?
Basically that they are going through a lot. They are not directly affected like Peter Germain was. They are indirectly affected about the strike going on in the country. But what amazes me is that they are all focused, and I think a lot has to do with the coach also, Fernando Clavijo, who is not Haitian but is slowly learning about the Haitian plight, yet he is also instilling in them a brand of soccer that they have not been accustomed to the last few qualifying rounds for previous World Cups. And I believe that combination of the passion that these players have and the motivation that they are gaining from all the problems that are going on back home, plus the expertise coming from this new coach, helped them at least in this round against Turks and Caicos. Now, granted, Turks and Caicos is not a soccer power, and these two victories were highly anticipated, but they believe that that right mix could lead them on even in the next round against Jamaica.
You mentioned that there was considerable rooting interest for the Haitian team in Miami. Do you have any sense of whether people in Haiti have responded to this? Has this been something to kind of help dispel at least a little bit the gloom and the terror going on there?
Unfortunately, I don't believe it is. It might have temporarily taken away from the current problems, but it's not a lasting effect. It'll become a permanent impression if they win the next round against Jamaica. That would be big because this was pretty much highly anticipated. Mm-hmm. But if this crisis endures for the next few months and happens to coincide with the next round against Jamaica, which is in June, and if somehow they advance past that round, then it'll hit big at home, whether the situation is still ongoing or whether it has leveled off.
Are there plans now for the team from Haiti to return home, or is it too early to even be thinking about that?
Well, the team has been training in Florida for months. They've had a lot of support. The Federation's president said in a press conference before the two games that they have been getting support from the exile community, and I don't anticipate them returning anytime soon until things, again, calm down. They have had a training camp nearby Broward County, and they also trained for a few weeks upstate. They have been basically working in Florida for these matches, for this World Cup qualifier, as well as the exhibition games they've played.
Santos Perez has been following the Haitian national soccer team for the Miami Herald, and as he said, that team from Haiti will next play Jamaica in June. Thank you, Mr. Perez.
Thank you.
Earlier this month, Ann Mariucci and Kathy Monroe purchased 25% of the Phoenix Mercury. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Steve Goldstein profiles the Arizona businesswomen who have become the WNBA's first female owners.
It's an historic day for many reasons. It's the first time an NBA team has ever partnered with outside investors in operating a WNBA team. They're the first women to be owners in this league.
With that announcement on February 2nd, Phoenix Mercury majority owner Jerry Colangelo had initiated a new phase for the WNBA. Last year, the league relaxed rules on outside ownership, and Colangelo contacted Mariucci and Monroe, both former CEOs in Phoenix and Mercury season ticket holders, about investing in the team. The women each ponied up $1 million for a 10% stake in the Mercury. Mariucci says the pair are interested in strengthening the Mercury and the WNBA, but there's more at stake than basketball.
It is role modeling for young girls. It's demonstrating the importance of discipline and teamwork. It's giving parents an alternative to Britney Spears and Janet Jackson as role models.
Ann and I grew up being women, always sort of being in the minority in terms of the business world.
Kathy Monroe.
We have an appreciation for what women's sports can do to help you at whatever you decide to do in life.
But the impact of Mariucci and Monroe will also be felt in the multi-billion-dollar business of sports. NBA Commissioner David Stern is interested in the bottom line, and the WNBA feels its future will depend upon bringing in new female ownership. WNBA President Val Ackerman.
We wanted to attract a category of ownership that has historically been underrepresented in pro sports, and by that category I refer to women.
If it's going to go off on its own and eventually thrive, women have to be involved.
USA Today columnist Christine Brennan has covered the WNBA since its inception. Brennan says Ann Mariucci and Kathy Monroe are in the vanguard of an irreversible trend.
They are to Phoenix and to sports ownership in Phoenix what Billie Jean King was to women's tennis and women's sports in a national and international way. They are the groundbreakers. They're the pioneers.
Susan O'Malley is the Washington Wizards president and the first woman to run an NBA team. O'Malley understands the challenges ahead of Mariucci and Monroe because she remembers how hard it was being the only woman in an NBA boardroom.
The difference was that you were the lone voice in the room, so when you said something, you were heard, which has its pluses and its minuses. The outside world thought she couldn't know anything about basketball, so how could she do this?
Majority owner Jerry Colangelo has made it clear that Mariucci and Monroe will be involved with every Phoenix Mercury decision, including roster moves. The team's average attendance has dropped 38% since 1997. Last year, the Mercury drew 8,500 fans per game, and the team had the WNBA's worst record in 2003. But with the first pick in April's league draft, the Mercury is focused on one woman it feels can reverse the downward trend, University of Connecticut forward Diana Taurasi. Anne Mariucci isn't looking far beyond that day, but can't help speculating about the future of women in the business of sports.
I'm sure that does include ownership of male professional sports franchises to the extent that it's a compelling business opportunity. So while that isn't a driving force for us in this purchase, I certainly wouldn't be at all surprised in my lifetime to see independently owned woman franchises of major professional sports.
For Only a Game, I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour.
The girls on the beach are all within reach.
This year's Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue so delighted Belpre, Ohio 12-year-old Justin Reyes that he decided to share it with members of the 6th grade class at his public school last week. He was summarily suspended for 3 days, and school officials recommended that he spend time at an alternative school. Justin's mom refused to abide by that recommendation and said, quote, "I doubt my 12-year-old is the only one looking at Sports Illustrated." Justin himself added, "You could see more bad stuff on the Super Bowl halftime show than in the magazine." Various Sports Illustrated subscribers concurred.
Yeah.
You go, Justin!
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, three-storied basketball coaches jump from the rocking chair into the hot seat. But first, 10 years ago, in a book entitled The Last Shot, Darcy Frey told the stories of several of the members of a championship high school basketball team in Coney Island, New York. Frey watched their unlikely acrobatics on neighborhood courts, and he listened as the young players were wooed by agents and coaches who promised their dreams of scholarships to Division I basketball schools and eventual NBA careers would come true. In the recently published paperback edition of The Last Shot, Darcy Frey has updated the stories of those high school stars of a decade ago. One of them, Stephon Marbury, is a member of the New York Knicks. His current contract will end up paying him over $100 million. His former teammates have not been so fortunate. Darcy Frey joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Darcy, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. It's great to be here.
And by Mr. Frey's side in New York today is Corey Johnson, one of the men whose exploits Darcy Frey chronicled. Corey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All of the stars of The Last Shot were, in fact, offered basketball scholarships to major schools. In that regard, at least, they beat the odds. But, Darcy, they couldn't all take advantage of those offers. What happened, for example, to Russell Thomas?
Russell Thomas was one of Lincoln's great players, incredibly disciplined, off guard with a deadly outside shot, an incredible defender. Just to clarify, his real name was Darryl Flicking. I called him Russell Thomas in the book. He had had some legal problems when he was younger than 18, so I changed his name. But he struggled with so many of the obstacles that a lot of the kids that I wrote about struggled with. First and foremost, he struggled with the SATs coming out of high school. He wasn't able to pass his SATs and get eligibility to play Division I, and this was after a senior year in which he had been recruited extremely highly and aggressively by lots of different college coaches. And when they withdrew their attention because of his academic struggles, I think he was quite heartbroken. He ended up going off to a junior college near Los Angeles, played extraordinarily well, shattered the state's community college scoring record during his 2 years, and once again got recruited very highly by some of the very same college coaches in Division I that had sought him in high school. This time, he was older, he was wiser, he was more suspicious, and he decided to turn down all of their offers and go to a Division II school where he thought that he would actually be able to study better, get more academic attention, and graduate from college. He did. He went to the University of California at Riverside and did graduate in 1996, but struggled enormously after graduating, couldn't find full-time employment, couldn't find housing, ended up homeless, ministering to other homeless men and women up and down the Southern California coast, becoming more and more despairing about the situation he was in. In January 1999, in an incident that many of his friends think was intentional, Russell was walking down some train tracks on the California coast and was hit by an Amtrak passenger train and died. He was 26 years old.
Corey, you left Coney Island for a junior college as well, the junior college in Texas, and I gather that that didn't turn out to be a smooth pathway to pro basketball.
No, actually, it was a fun decision. But once I got there, I realized how the whole game is nothing but a meat market. And, you know, the coaches, they really just want to go with the guys who, you know, want to do whatever they say. They didn't really challenge me with the classes and everything whenever I was looking for help as far as studying and this and that. It was always a runaround, but we always had to be there and practice on time and learn the plays and all that other BS. But, you know, I didn't like it after a while. It was not a challenge for me, so I wanted to leave and get out of there. Plus, there was a lot of danger surrounding the school where, like, people who lived off campus would come on campus and have fights and stuff like that. And I was like, I got to get out of here.
Have you stayed in touch with any or all of your teammates from Lincoln High School? And are you surprised that Stephen Marbury is the only one who's currently in the NBA?
No, not at all. I'm not surprised. I mean, I knew this was destined for Stephon ever since he was a kid. I mean, I watched him grow up. We lived in the same building. We're related. So it's like we saw that happening before it even happened. So I'm not surprised at all about that. For myself, I'm definitely not surprised because I never had NBA dreams. I always used basketball for the benefits of, you know, traveling, getting free sneakers and all, having all kinds of fun and stuff like that. I really always wanted to be a writer, so I've always had that in the back of my mind. And it was funny when the article came out in the New York Times and the title read Betrayed by the Game, I really felt like it was more betrayal by the people who work in the game as far as the coaching, the fans and all of this stuff. I mean, I had people who was more concerned with me, you know, pursuing the NBA rather than being a writer. And that was tough for me because I felt like my intelligence was being insulted. All I ever did was write and read books ever since I was a kid. So I felt like, why am I getting so much support playing basketball when I really wanted it for the writing, you know? As far as Daryl, that was my best friend. I still think about him all the time. He has so much potential. Yeah, it's disheartening all the time when I think about him and what he had to go through. But it was like kind of like the same story for him. Once he decided he didn't want basketball anymore and he actually wanted to pursue being a registered nurse, it's like people would laugh at things like that. You know, I'm like, you know, how do you get so much support and love for wanting to be a basketball player when it is just a game? And for me, I want to be a voice for a lot of those kids that are out there being pressured to play a sport and thinking that's their only route in life rather than just being who you really want to be, you know, and pursuing your own dream.
Darcy, at the end of the last shot, you point out that fewer than 1% of the high school basketball players in the country get scholarships to play Division I basketball, and you refer to the process of playing basketball in order to get a college scholarship as, quote, a cruel parody of the American dream. Has your assessment of that situation changed in the 10 years since the book originally appeared?
You know, I finished the book, and it was originally published in 1994, and I had a pretty strong opinion about it at the time. Getting in touch with the players in the last few months and talking to them has actually made me feel even more strongly that this is a kind of cruel parody of the American dream, that the system is a hoax, and that it does not offer what is promise to these kids. And I wanted to point out too that the kids that I was following were not all deluded into thinking that they were going to be NBA stars. As Corey just said, what he wanted was a college scholarship that would help him with his writing. What Daryl wanted was a college scholarship that would help him become a registered nurse. These were kids that were using remarkable skills that they had developed in order to better their lives. And their goals were, you know, a Division I scholarship, a college education, a college degree, a decent job after graduation. And even those much more modest goals seem to be beyond the reach of a lot of the kids that I followed.
Darcy Frey is the author of The Last Shot, City Streets, Basketball Dreams, a paperback edition of the book with an afterword has just been published by Mariner Books. Darcy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill, for having us on the show.
And Corey Johnson, an aspiring writer, played for Coney Island's Lincoln High School back in 91. Corey, thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show, Bill. It's been a pleasure being here.
Magic Johnson failed to do it. Dennis Rodman failed to do it. Michael Jordan twice failed to do it. It, in this case, is staying retired once one has become familiar with the rhythm of the rocking chair and the contours of the porch swing. And as Greg Eklund reports, that syndrome has recently affected at least three current and formerly former college basketball head coaches.
So you're a college head coach with 543 wins, good for 11th in the all-time list. You're financially set and have been enjoying 4 years of retired life. What else do you need?
And welcome back to the Tom Davis Show on a Tuesday night. I'm Warren Swain with the head coach of the Bulldogs, Tom Davis.
How about another head coaching job? Last April, Drake University in Des Moines hired 63-year-old Dr. Tom Davis, who coached the University of Iowa basketball team from 1986 to 1999, and Stanford, Boston College, and Lafayette for 15 years before that. But Davis is not alone. 60-year-old Dick Bennett at Washington State and Homer Drew at Valparaiso are back in big-time college basketball this season after it appeared that they, too, had walked away from coaching for good. At a recent Drake practice, I asked Davis why he wanted to subject himself to the pressures of coaching once more.
You do ask yourself that occasionally. You say, well, what am I doing? One of my good friends that I started in college coaching with, his name is Tom Young. Thomas, I don't want to give his total age away, but he's in his 70s now. And he and I had both been out of coaching. And when it was announced that I was coming back to Drake, he sent me an email and he said, TD, what the hell?
Davis says that if he hadn't been persuaded to coach again, he would have gladly carried on with his retirement.
Oh, yeah, very much. Enjoyed it a lot. He had a time to do all the things he didn't have time to do previously, read the books and do the walks and exercise, travel, whatever it was that you wanted to do, you had time to do it.
But Davis says being Drake's head coach appealed to him, as did the opportunity to work with a coach he considers near and dear.
Come on.
Drake assistant coach Keno Davis is Tom Davis's son. Dick Bennett and Homer Drew have also shared the bench with offspring. Davis admits that Keno's pipe dreaming was a factor in his return to coaching.
Oh, absolutely. I think that was a factor, knowing that he could then. He had always been kind of kidding me when I was out that if I ever got back in, he wanted to work for me, and it'd be kind of half in jest. But I knew he was serious, that it was something he wanted to do. So that was certainly something that did have some appeal.
They've got to go the length of the court with 2.5 left. Sykes, long pass. Bill Jenkins, through three for the win! Go!
Oh, my!
Go!
Not only was that shot in 1998 by Bryce Drew one of the NCAA tournament's most memorable moments, it was a snapshot for the Drew family album. Bryce made the shot. Homer looked on as father and head coach, with assistant coach Scott Drew, Homer's other son, at his side. When Drew retired after his first stint as head coach in 2002, Scott Drew stepped into the breach. During Homer Drew's only year of retirement, he wasn't completely detached.
I'd get phone calls a couple times a day and say, you know, Dad, what about this scenario? And we would talk about the options, and then he would make the decision. So he kept me close enough to the action that I still felt very much involved.
When Scott Drew moved on last summer to take over as Baylor's head coach, Homer Drew thought it best to take over a Valpo team he already knew well. Homer Drew, who posted a 236-185 record in his first go-round at Valpo, doesn't look at this as an interim situation.
This group has re-energized and re-motivated myself. They're a good group. They want to get better. They want to play. And so they've been fun to work with. So they've been like the energizing bunny to me.
While Valpo has positioned itself as a contender for an NCAA tournament berth in the Mid-Continent Conference, Drake is a long shot in the Missouri Valley Conference. Davis is trying to get the Bulldogs back to respectability, a formidable task considering that they haven't had an overall record above 500 since 1987. He felt he could turn Drake's basketball program around because he had been through the same rebuilding process before.
I knew how bad they had been, and yet I had a pretty good handle at what some of the problems were. Having coached at Lafayette, at Boston College, at Stanford, places like that where you had some of the same problems that a Drake will have in terms of getting the basketball program going.
Drake plays its final home game of the season this afternoon. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Des Moines, Iowa.
First season leading your Drake Bulldogs, Dr. Tom Davis.
Back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again, whoopee-tie-i-o, rocking to and fro. Back in the saddle again, whoopee-tie-i-yay, I go my way. Back in the saddle again.
You're listening to Only a Game.
We take you now to Harry Carey's restaurant.
On Thursday night at Harry Carey's restaurant in Chicago, the infamous Bartman ball, the ball not caught by Cubs outfielder Moises Alou in Game 6 of last fall's National League Championship Series, was destroyed by a combination of pressure, heat, and explosives. Joining me now on the line from Chicago is Harry Carey's restaurant group managing partner Grant DePorter, who purchased the sinister sphere in December for the express purpose of destroying it. Mr. DePorter, let's start with your eyewitness account of the ball's destruction.
There was like this, I don't know if you've seen it, but it was like this golden tower with these orbs on top that started a electrical charge, some kind of sonic tube electrical charge thing, you know, boom, 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 boom. And then when it hit the ball, I mean, the ball was completely obliterated. And it was contained in like this bulletproof glass container so that none of these pieces will fly all over the room.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the effect on Cub fans. Is everybody in Chicago now sure that the Cubs win the World Series this season?
Well, I don't know if it's so much the balls or, you know, Dusty Baker bringing on Greg Maddux. It really was more of a function of, let's just get some closure on it, because the Cub fans helped participate in the destruction, you know, like how its last 48 hours, what the ball was doing. The Cub fans said, hey, send it up to Wrigley Field to say goodbye. So we did that. Someone said, hey, let it have its last night with a, you know, a good steak dinner and let us sleep in a hotel. And then they said, why don't you have a masseuse come in and give it a massage? So they did that. It was like a catharsis effect for all Cub fans everywhere because they participated, and that brought them closure, and everyone said that.
Before the ball was destroyed, you said, and I'm quoting, it's like the ring from Lord of the Rings, and we're kind of like Frodo trying to get it over with. Even though the ball is now gone, do the Cubs have to really win a World Series before people feel they can, you know, really rejoice?
Certainly. I mean, that's what everyone wants more than anything. I mean, just the energy in October this last year, watching, I mean, it was unreal. I mean, if Cubs winning the World Series would be the biggest thing of any type of sport of all time. I mean, everyone's just waiting for that moment. And really, I think that last year was just a little taste, and I think that the ownership of the Cubs, everyone, they will not settle for anything less than World Series.
Grant DePorter is a managing partner of Harry Carey's Restaurant Group. He joined me on the line from Chicago. Mr. DePorter, congratulations on the spectacle, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, you got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, and know when to allow a huge television audience to see your hand. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look of the week sports news. Hello, Charlie.
See, here's my hand. Huge radio audience.
Yeah,
see, right there.
It doesn't
see?
Work on radio.
So look at that.
Former Giants manager Dusty Baker doesn't want to talk about Barry Bonds and steroids, but Colorado Rockies Turk Wendell and Denny Nagel do. Is it going to be like this all summer?
Yes, it is, because we are living through the age of wonderful, perfect storm of ambitious politicians, moralistic media, and ironclad innuendo. Dusty Baker has been pilloried all week for saying that the current atmosphere around baseball and steroids is like McCarthyism. That's only because it is. Testing negative doesn't matter. Evidence doesn't matter. As long as you seem to have lost weight, you're guilty.
I think Dusty Baker should be celebrated as a guy who's employed in professional sports and actually knows some U.S. history.
Well, that's a very good point. I'm assuming he means the Joe McCarthy who was the senator from Wisconsin.
Rather than
and not the,
one.
The Joe McCarthy who managed the Red Sox.
Another former Belco
both
client.
Both drunks, by the way, in case anyone should ask.
Another former Belco client, Dwayne Chambers, the European 100-meter champion who tested positive for the steroid THG, has been banned from the Olympics for life, or until he can successfully appeal. What do you think it'll be?
Grounded for life. I don't know. This one looks like they're very serious about it. Again, though, this is an interesting case because he's found guilty by the track and field poobahs in the United Kingdom, even though THG wasn't banned.
Because they hadn't known enough about it to ban it.
Correct. But right. It wasn't banned when he did it.
Right.
This is the problem that's going to catch these people up for the foreseeable future. Because why, Bill? Science marches on. And the next generation is going to be harder to detect. And guess what? People are going to take it. Now, unless you want to commit yourself to the proposition that there is nothing ever correct in taking a substance to make your performance better, no matter how healthy or benign that substance may be, you're going to get caught in this trap every 3 or 4 years for the foreseeable future.
Jamal Lewis of the Baltimore Ravens has been charged with possession of 5 kilograms of cocaine, which he allegedly intended to distribute. 5 kilograms, Charlie, help me with the conversion from metric. That's a fair amount, right?
Oh, Bill, I spill most of that out of my pockets on weekends. No.
It's about 11 pounds,
it's
I think,
11
right?
pounds of cocaine. Exactly. That is a small ceramic horse filled with cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
This is based on the testimony of an FBI informant. There's going to be the usual Law and Order episode about why is the informant saying that? Is the informant only serving up a famous person to get the informant's case dismissed, blah, blah, blah. This will ride every ride in the jury system. What is clear, though, is that Jamal Lewis has a long way to go before he's ever an NFL player again.
In Athens on Thursday, a gang firebombed 2 Greek government vehicles and said the attack was meant to coincide with IOC President Jacques Roga's presence in Greece. What do these folks have against the 2004 Olympics exactly?
These are the all-purpose anarchist, syndicalist, crazy left that floats around Europe. They have sort of, in an interesting marketing technique, started to call themselves Phavos and Athena, which are the names of the two cuddly Olympic mascots.
Absolutely.
For Athens. They have bigger problems, I think, though. Apparently, about 200 property owners had their land sort of expropriated or taken by whatever eminent domain is in Greece and used for Olympic sites. And they're protesting because the government hasn't paid them for the land the government has taken. Lots of luck there, folks. These guys could be a lot more trouble than the crazy mascot people.
There's another disturbing story out of Boulder involving University of Colorado football coach in exile Gary Barnett, who may have required his freshman players to curry favor with the local police. I do not understand why any coach would have that on his mind with all those X's and O's.
All right, now isn't it time for, like, the chief of police in Boulder to take a paid leave of absence? I mean, this is, you know, we all laugh, we all joke, and we all have a good time with the fundamental corruption that's at the heart of college sports. But when it starts doing things like corrupting your police department, it's time to start throwing some indictments around.
And the deal here is that freshman football players were required to ride around with the police, so they'd become pals.
So they'd become familiar with each other's faces. So, you know, if they were doing something nasty, oh, there's my friend the cop. I can do this. Good.
The NCAA basketball tournament Selection Sunday is only 2 weeks away, Charlie, and so speculation has already begun about various teams, quote, on the bubble. One of my favorite phrases. Any bubble balancers you'd especially like to see at the dance?
Well, yes, my own, because
we stink this year.
Embarrassingly enough, we can play our way onto the bubble. Marquette can by winning out, which I don't think they're going to do, by the way, because it has been a rough and rocky season for the lads, but we'll have to see. There are a couple of interesting bubble teams in, for example, the Atlantic Coast Conference. Maryland's a pretty good team, but they're also very young, and they've also got some terrible losses. As is the case, the Big 12 has three or four teams that are going to get in and three or four teams that are going to get out, and you can throw a blanket over all of them. Oklahoma has just been awful, and they're still on the bubble. And in your own Big East Conference, I think, as I always do, that if it's in any way possible to put Notre Dame in the tournament, somebody will find a way to do it.
Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, is apparently set to follow in the television footsteps of Donald Trump. Tell us about the next superb viewing experience we can anticipate.
Mark Cuban is the benefactor. He's going to give away $1 million. And why, says ABC? Because he can.
There you go.
I figure he's just, you know, the cookie jar is too full, and he's got to take out some money. So what he's going to do is he's going to set up a bunch of stuff that people have to do, and when the guy he decides completely arbitrarily is the winner is going to get $1 million. And as he says, the right person is going to get on my good side at the right time and get $1 million. Mark, love your team. Really. I love the Dallas Mavericks.
For TV, that's not going to do it, man. You're at least going to have to eat bugs or swim in big
beans.
No,
he says no, no. He says no. It's going to be kind of a dignified thing.
Oh, dignified. Yeah, dignified's the word that leaps to mind from this one.
From the gozillionaire who once worked at the Dairy Queen.
And finally, Charlie, a German man given to gambling is grateful to the police in Berlin for recovering his dentures, which had been snatched away from him as collateral for a gambling debt. A lesson to all who would bet on sports or anything else, I suppose, right?
Yes, and remember, Bill, I'm going to say it because no one else has. The gambling laws in this country really have teeth in them.
Charlie Pierce sinks his teeth into the most appetizing sports stories each week here on Only Game. He also writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. Thank you, Charlie.
Mark, baby, you and me, pal, right here.
Luck be a lady.
On Wednesday night, cable television viewers can tune in to the second season premiere of the Travel Channel's World Poker Tour. Over the past year, poker on TV has become a rapidly growing phenomenon, breaking records on cable television and even attracting more than 10 million viewers on NBC opposite this year's pre-Super Bowl coverage. Only a Game's Karen Given takes a look at the trend that has novices anteing up and poker pros eyeing the ever-growing pot.
What's up, my boy? Table six, bring me back.
Where's my number four there, Jimmy?
Jim Christina surveys the room with a sly grin as he sets the cards in motion for Foxwood Casino's weekly No Limit Texas Hold'em poker tournament. Around each felt-top table sits 10 poker hopefuls, all of whom have ponied up $235 for their chance at today's top prize, worth close to $10,000.
There's 140 today.
On a Tuesday morning.
On a Tuesday morning, and we started registration at 8 o'clock this morning. Just to give you an idea, we had tournaments on Saturdays and Sundays up until last week. Last week we had sold out 200 people by 7:30 in the morning, and we had to shut out 300 people. so it wasn't pretty.
Al Latanzio has been playing tournaments like this one for 7 years, and he's had to make a few adjustments since poker's hit it big.
This used to be a tournament that you could come down and register 15 minutes before the tournament started. Now we have to wait in line an hour, 2 hours before the tournament because we're afraid of being shut out. So the poker boom has brought people into the poker room who weren't here before.
The most successful of poker's new brood is Chris Moneymaker, who spent just $40 online to win a $10,000 entry into the 2003 World Series of Poker. At the end of the month-long tournament, he took home top prize, $2.5 million. But not every budding card shark's foray into poker is successful.
5-3. Oh, he gets the free toaster oven, first one out. The first person just got knocked out of the tournament. This is no limit hold'em, so at any time you're able to push in all your chips. And if you don't happen to have the best hand, there you go. Well, he paid $230 to get into the tournament today, and he's lasted 6 minutes.
Most will last considerably longer than 6 minutes. It will take 9 or 10 hours before today's winner is decided. Then, some number of players will come back tomorrow for another $235 tournament. Again, Jim Christina.
What's happened to poker over the last year or 2 years since the internet started and since the TV program on the Travel Channel every Wednesday night has just been unbelievable. It's going to be the decade of hold'em poker.
Champion Robert Varconi opens up the table here with a nice $2,500 pot in our No Limit Texas Hold'em Tournament.
Now, as everybody knows by now, the game we play here, Celebrity Poker Showdown, is, of course, No Limit Texas Hold'em. But just so
the name of the game is No Limit Texas Hold'em, the Cadillac of Poker. This is a game that takes a minute to learn and a lifetime to master.
On television, No Limit Texas Hold'em is the name of the game, and the World Poker Tour's Steve Lipscomb was the first to bring it to the big time. Poker's been on TV since 1992, but with low production values and no way to tell what cards players were holding, Lipscomb says watching poker on TV was like watching paint dry. He convinced an investor to back his broadcasts, which use as many as 16 cameras and cost up to $400,000 per episode.
Right next to him, Phil Ivey throwing away a king nine.
Well, that's the real beauty of the World Poker Tour, is that we actually get to see these players down cards. The audience actually gets to pretend like they're sitting in that seat. What would they do? How would they bet?
Lipscomb also convinced players to let viewers see their cards through tiny cameras embedded in the poker tables. The idea caught on, and within a year, ESPN had installed the same cameras in the tables for the World Series of Poker. And Bravo countered with a Hollywood version called Celebrity Poker Showdown, in which actress Nicole Sullivan of the sitcom King of Queens and comedian David Cross, dressed only in a bathrobe, played for their favorite charities.
I'm counting my kitty cat Sorry. Money. That's 5 more penises removed from male cats. It's true. It's true. It's my charities, I promise. It's one of my charities.
Wow, the orphans that I'm doing the charity for are going to be psyched about that.
What? No more milk? Oh, but a cat didn't have his removed. That's all right. That's all right with me. I'm so cold and oh.
What the celebrity version lacks in serious poker strategy, it gains in popular appeal. And Celebrity Poker Showdown was quickly picked up for a second season. The World Poker Tour has recently aired its own celebrity version, but CEO Steve Lipscomb says he's not worried about the competition.
Fun and irritating to watch at the same time is that they're just taking all that hard work that I did in an edit bay for 8 months editing our first show and just copying it. And I think the great thing is we spend so much time, love, and care to do what we do that I don't think anybody has come close to what we've done.
For the pros, there's a lot to be gained from all this television exposure. Tournaments are open to anyone willing to pay the entry fee, upwards of $10,000 on the WPT. The more players, the more money there is to win. The World Poker Tour paid out $10 million over its first season, a figure Steve Lipscomb expects to triple this year. And two-time WPT champion Howard Lederer, dubbed the professor of poker by commentators, has found another use for televised poker.
Do I go back and watch? Oh, absolutely. Yes, I burn them to DVD. I study them. I take them with me on the road. If I'm in a poker tournament and I know someone is at my table the next day, I can go up to my room and I can study that guy. You know, this is, we're playing for big money. I owe it to myself to put that kind of effort into it.
Poker pros aren't the only ones learning from television. To help World Poker Tour fans at home figure out if they'd rather have big slick wired sevens or pocket bullets as their starting hand, a box at the bottom of the screen explains the common lingo. And just to make sure you're paying attention, from time to time, there's a quiz.
You've got aces. Would you rather your opponent held pocket kings or wired sevens? Answer after the break.
By the way, the answer is kings. With all this edutainment, it's easy to see why television viewers are trying their hand in the casinos and on the internet. But Howard Lederer says not everyone in poker's elite was so willing to share their secrets on national TV.
I just basically said, hooey, we've got to do this. This is going to be great TV. And the people at home are going to learn. I mean, definitely watching good players play, exposing their whole cards, will get you from point A to point G pretty quickly. But getting all the way to Z is like a whole other animal.
Initials.
Yes, F.
That's all.
Back at the Foxwoods Poker Room in Connecticut, players line up for hours to see if they can work their way to point Z and the big payouts. In a windowless office just a few feet from the neon lights of the casino floor, Kathy Raymond, Foxwoods Director of Poker Operations, fields phone calls and email from new players looking to join in. Foxwoods has a lot to gain from the newfound popularity of televised poker. Still, Raymond seems sincere when she says poker is not a spectator sport.
If I watch tennis, do I want to go out and play? Yeah. Do I have the opportunity to play in these big events? No. Do I get the same feeling watching poker? Yes. Can I go and play in these big events? Yeah, I can. And that's what makes poker different. You start out as a spectator, and you can end up a champion.
Season 2 of the Travel Channel's World Poker Tour begins on March 3rd. Viewers will have to wait until spring for new installments of Bravo's Celebrity Poker Showdown and ESPN's World Series of Poker. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Boris Strapachki and from Manya at NPR's New York Bureau. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear any part of this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or even learn how to play No Limit Texas Hold'em Poker, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from World Poker Tour CEO Steve Lipscomb, who predicts who will tune in on Wednesday for his program's second season premiere.
All those fantastic NPR addicts like myself, and I tell you, that's more addicting than poker.
Well, heck, if that's the case, why not create a new program called the National Public Radio Television Show? That'll show all those people who say I have a face for radio. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.